The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Talking about Rupert Murdoch getting engaged at 92, Joe Biden's age. But I want to invite this guy back with us. I read about him, and Lou Gonzalez found him, and we put him on our YouTube show, and he's brilliant. Mike Domino joins us. Michael, thanks for doing this, man. Welcome back to Denver on a Saturday.
Hey, Peter. It's great to be back with you.
Yeah. I don't know if you're a fight fan or not, because it's away from why you're with us, but Tyson's getting back in the ring. He's going to be 58 years old when he fights Jake Paul. And this was no preset interview between you and I, but I'm watching this stuff and I'm thinking, "Whoa, boy, Mike Tyson." So, and all of these,
I know, it's crazy. We'll see what happens. I mean, you know, you've got a lot of these, you know, influencers and sort of, you know, Jake Paul's kind of been, you know, sort of building to this, I think, for a while. And it's not surprising to me that this ended up happening, but who knows? I mean, I wouldn't want to bet against Mike Tyson.
No, talking about that. And Paul's 27 and he's a tough kid. I mean, he comes off the street. He's a rough kid. And I checked at the break. He's 9-2. Tyson's like 50 and I don't know what he is,
right?
but he'll be 58 when the bell rings. Wow.
Yeah.
Mike did a YouTube shoot with us, and it was really good. We really went, I think, very deep on Ukraine, and also that we share. I got to know him and spend time with him, John McCain, and you worked with McCain. Michael, do your background first, if you would, please.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I am a national security expert right now at a think tank called Defense Priorities. We're a 501c3, we're nonpartisan, nonprofit, and we focus on U.S. foreign policy, right, and trying to have a more realistic and responsible approach to U.S. foreign policy. You know, most of my career was spent in the intelligence community, the better part of the last decade. I was a CIA officer. I spent a little time at DOD, but before all that, I kind of got my start in the, you know, foreign policy and political world. As an intern with John McCain's office in the Senate. And it was a phenomenal experience as you know, a college student at American University in D.C. And I got sort of a really great opportunity to be a fly on the wall for all of these really fantastic, you know, meetings and other things that he was, you know, running around Capitol Hill doing. And I think he was a great leader. And look, like we talked about earlier, Peter, you know, you can you know, disagree with maybe some of the policies or, you know, maybe our approach to Libya or other issues. But I do think Senator McCain was a great leader and a great man. And I think that he really was, you know, trying to put his best foot forward and make the best decisions he could, you know, for the country at the time. And, you know, like we talked about, you know, he really did earn that reputation as a maverick. I think people, you know, even on his staff, we, you know, sometimes we didn't even know what he was going to do, right? So, he has a great legacy, and I think too, you know, it's interesting though to see kind of the differences, you know, to be honest with you, between, you know, some of his views on some of these issues and where a lot of the Republican Party is going at this point. And I do think that change is kind of a good thing in many ways. And we talked a little bit about this last time, right? Whether it's Ukraine or what's going on in the Middle East, I think we should be careful of getting, you know, falling back into another war here that ends up taking up, you know, the next decade or two of our sort of bandwidth.
I agree. My experience with McCain, I talked about, he really, really impressed me. He had done a book about his father and his grandfather. That's where we met. And it's a very powerful book about SLU and Popeye. And came into the studio, and we clicked. And he was clear that I'd read the book. And I knew something about him, and we ended up having sandwiches together in the boardroom of no, serious, a Clear Channel, and he had an aide with him, and I thought, wonder if that was you, but there was a sandwich cart in the lobby, and somebody said, what was he like? I said, he was a sailor.
Yeah.
And you don't forget that he was principally a sailor.
Yep.
And then the second time I met him, and the same thing. I mean, like I said, his military career was what it was. But boy, I'll tell you what, he was about half tough. And but you know, like I said, I mean, he regaled me with stories. He would just tell one story after another, and particularly his, how much he loved his father and how much he loved his grandfather. And they were all of them, and they were all Annapolis grads, you know, and they were all who they were. But, boy, they just must have been some tough old guys.
Yeah, and I think anybody that spent time with him and having, you know, watched him interact with foreign leaders and even other, you know, colleagues in the Senate, I mean, he really did have the gift of gab, and he really was a phenomenal at kind of getting to know people and getting to know sort of, you know, how to click with people. He really was gifted in that sense. And it's kind of funny. I mean, we don't have, I don't think, you know, as many politicians today that are quite as, I don't know, quite sort of naturally smooth at that.
You know, I agree. He would, as I said, he would turn the air blue. I mean, he spoke like a sailor, and he would, you know, like, but I was just, wow, you know, McCain. And, there, you know, there were those guys, the Tip O'Neills and those guys, you know, Ronald Reagan, for the lack of, you know, one of my true favorite American presidents. And there were those guys, and they found a way. And today, there is no find a way. There's just us and them and us.
Yeah, I think, you know, it may sound cliche, but I do think we're more divided than we've ever been. I think we're more partisan than we've ever been. And that's never a good thing, right?
No.
Regardless of what side you're on or how strongly you feel, we've got to find ways to find some kind of agreement, right? Or we're going to be in trouble here over the next couple of years.
So when I watched Joe Biden's State of the Union, and he harkens back to FDR and goes through all of that, and he came out and he led on the Ukraine, which, you know, I thought he did better than I thought he was going to do. By the way, Mike DiMano is our guest. He's a public policy manager and worked in CIA. I just really enjoyed having him on. And then he goes right into this Vladimir Putin is sort of this modern day Joe Stalin. He really wants Poland and he wants to take Eastern Europe. And that's further from the truth, I think, than I can even imagine. Michael, what was your sense of that?
Yeah, look, I watched the State of the Union, and I think that, you know, overall, you know, I'd probably give President Biden, you know, a C or maybe a B minus. Look, he was kind of shouting the entire time. Mm-hmm. It was sort of a strange delivery. I think, you know, whatever aide told him that would be a good strategy to sort of, you know, allay these age concerns, I don't think that was necessarily a good look. He did, you know, come out with high energy, and he did, I think, you know, kind of hit the points that, you know, his, you know, sort of Democratic, you know, base would want him to hit. But I think it was interesting, right? On the foreign policy side of it, which is my, you know, expertise, he led with Russia and Ukraine, but we didn't hear anything about what the strategy is.
Yeah.
We didn't hear anything about what is in the third year of this very bloody war. What is the end state going to look like? Is Ukraine going to be part of NATO? Is it going to be, are we going to go forward with an arms neutrality model like myself and other people have argued for? Are we going to, you know, change our level of support in any way? What are the indicators for how successful Ukraine should be on the battlefield? We didn't hear anything about that. We just heard, to your point, Peter, a very quick sort of, you know, Vladimir Putin is the worst guy in the world, and we should stand by Ukraine. And that's great. But it is the responsibility of the president to put forward the strategy to the American people, right, if we're going to continue to be invested in this conflict. And I don't think he did that. And look, if you go back to other presidents, right, Republicans and Democrats, you go back and you look at State of the Unions under Obama or under Bush, they would get into the detail. They would get into the strategy. President Obama talked about the surge and what the plan is, right? Whether you agree with it or not, he at least laid out the argument. So Joe Biden just sort of said, you know, Putin's awful and Ukraine's good and that's it. And it's like, well, that's great. Even, you know, sure, even if we all agree on that, what's the strategy? And I don't think he addressed that. And again, like we've talked about before, Peter, there's this weird argument that a lot of these Democrats make where they say, you know, Ukraine is winning and Russia is weakened and they're a paper tiger. And then at the same sentence, they will tell you that Russia is about to take Germany and Poland and the Baltic and everything, which is just not true from a military standpoint. And the other thing I'll say, too, you know, we didn't hear anything else about foreign policy in that speech until the very end when the president got to Gaza very quickly. And he mentioned this plan for this pier, the Navy is going to build, right, where we're going to, you know, develop a little modular causeway system. And we're basically going to park that right into the shore in Gaza to try to deliver aid. And look, I think myself and other folks that have spent time in the intelligence community or the military are very concerned about U.S. boots on the ground. And I know he didn't say
there will be
boots on the ground.
But you can't be. I mean, I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but how are you building a pier and there's no boots on the ground?
Exactly. Exactly, Peter. And that's a real concern. And this is a bigger issue, right? Regardless of how you feel about the situation in Gaza or the need for more aid or whatever, that is totally beside the point. If you're going to have American sailors and Marines on the beach in Gaza on a pier in Gaza where they're going to be attacked by Hamas,
Houthis,
or these ships are going to be the Houthis are going to be way more in range now. I mean, this is a serious concern for us getting roped into the war directly.
I wrote a column I get to write here, and Barbara Tuchman, who's one of my true favorites to read, the idea of a tripwire war. And she makes a case on the First World War that one to the next to the next to the next, and then somebody trips on the wire and, you know, begins in Sarajevo, but it ends with how it ends. And I fear this so much that Ukraine's one thing, but getting involved in the in Middle East is another. And I don't know how he can make the claim that they're going to build this pier, which I can't even imagine how elaborate that's going to be, and there's going to be no Americans with their feet on the ground there, which is a virtual impossibility.
Yeah, look, I think it's very important for journalists at the Pentagon and the White House press corps to really be pushing the administration for details and answers on what this is going to look like, because you're right, Peter, even if you're talking about using some of these modular building systems that the Navy has, what we call joint logistics over the shore, JLOT. John McCain was a big fan of these systems, by the way, too. They're very effective at building this small little pier. But at the end of the day, like you said, Peter, I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out that it's got to connect to the shore at some point, right?
Someplace.
So that's where the issue is. It's sort of a dishonest claim by the president that there won't be any boots on the ground. I mean, there definitely will be. And then the bigger questions are, who is going to protect the beachhead?
Yeah.
Is it going to be us? Is it going to be the Israelis? I mean, how exposed are we going to be to some kind of attack? I mean, I get very concerned, Peter, about, you know, what we saw at the end of Afghanistan with the suicide bombing at Abbey Gate, where you had crowds of desperate, you know, people. And it was very hard to have situational awareness of what was going on. And somebody got an attack off and killed 13 Americans. And I'm very concerned that we could see something like this, too. And that's why I would argue that regardless of how you feel about the war, regardless of how you feel about aid, if you care about the United States not getting, you know, dragged into another war here, we have to make sure that this plan either does not go forward or that there are some serious answers provided by the White House on how this is going to look.
13 after 10, 53 will be the high. Mike DeMeo is our guest. He's been with us on the shoot. Former CIA guy. Well, after as we're talking about Joe Biden's speech, Joe starts the speech by, I think, trying to portray, I think you pointed out, confidence and that he's competent. And he begins by turning his attention to his new favorite subjects, democracy and freedom. And he starts this stuff with the Ukraine against the Russian invasion. And Well, what do you think? What do you think? I mean, I'm reading Putin's life now, and I just, man. And what do you think Putin, you and I have agreed about this, but you go first. What is Putin's war aim in Ukraine? And what is Joe Biden's war aim in arming all of these people?
Well, sure. First, you know, to Putin, if you're familiar with his history and his background, like I know you are, Peter, but for people in the audience, right? I mean, this guy was a KGB officer that watched the fall of the Soviet Union firsthand. You know, he sort of does believe in an element of, you know, restoring sort of, you know, Russia's role in the world as a great power. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But I think, look, the main aims for Russia in the war have to do with creating sort of buffer space between it and NATO, right, which Russia has always viewed as an existential threat. And I think part of what they're trying to accomplish in the east, right, with attacking these provinces in eastern Ukraine, right, in the Donbass, in Zaporizhia, and Kherson, is to build a land bridge, basically, to Crimea, which would help Russia sort of guarantee a better, what it feels is a better and more stable long-term security posture. So I do think the focus on the fighting in the east is really Russia's main goal here. And I don't think that there's really anything that they're going to do to give up the about 20% of Ukraine that they've already taken. And again, this is where my perspective comes in here, that whether we think this is, you know, morally right or wrong, or that it was a tragedy or whatever, I agree with all that. But look, the situation is the situation. Russia has 20% of the land. We have to find a way to, you know, look forward here based on the facts on the ground. We spent all of last year arming and preparing Ukraine for their counteroffensive, which did not succeed, right? Which some people were saying was going to reclaim Crimea, right? And they didn't come anywhere close to that. And so I think we have to be honest about the situation on the ground. And I think right now there's not a lot of movement on the front line, right? Russia has some advantages at the moment, but nobody has made any kind of breakthrough. And I don't think it's likely that either side really will. And so you have to beg the question, you know, okay, so what, you know, when do we get to a negotiated settlement, and how can we help ensure a sovereign and independent Ukraine beyond this conflict? And I think that's where, to answer your first question, we don't really have an answer on what Joe Biden's strategy is.
No, we
have no clue.
Yeah,
and people that I'm close with in the administration have told me privately they have no idea what the strategy is, right? So this is what's really disappointing and should be concerning to Americans, is even if you want to support Ukraine, I think the bare minimum is to ask for a strategy and a plan and an outcome, and where are we going here, and what is this going to look like? Because to your point, Peter, if we don't have a clear end state in mind, we do risk the tripwire war scenario that Barbara Tuchman and others have pointed out.
Listen, and you can read Putin, and I talk about Putin and Jack Kennedy, but and I just finished reading this lengthy piece on Jack Kennedy in Cuba, and when the missiles are discovered, Khrushchev puts the missiles there, and the forward thrust of NATO, and I don't even know why NATO exists anymore, because there was the day of the Warsaw Pact and NATO was the counterbalance. Well, that's all out the window now, and Warsaw Pact's gone, and many of old Warsaw Pact members are now members of NATO. But like the Romanovs or the Stalinists or whomever, they see this as a threat. Now, I listened to a little bit of people on talk radio, and I wonder that they grasp this, that this is what the Romanovs would do, let alone Joe Stalin. We can't have these people armed, because if Ukraine's going into NATO, then where does all of that lead, Michael?
Well, yeah, I think a lot of people gloss over the very serious risks here of just sort of casually, you know, adding Ukraine to NATO while it is in a state of war with Russia. I mean, right there, you know, we all know you have Article 5 in NATO, right, which triggers that collective defense agreement. And you basically, if you wanted to add Ukraine to NATO right now, you would immediately have Article 5 deliberation. And then you'd have, you know, the entire Western world directly involved in a war with Russia. And I think this is it's just very clear that this is not in American interests, right? And it is disappointing to me that when people make the case for Ukraine, they do tend to make, you know, sort of these more nebulous arguments about, about democracy or about
freedom,
you know, sort
freedom,
of America's
freedom, yeah,
right
yeah,
freedom
yeah,
in some
yeah.
sense. And look, I'm for all that, but at the same time, there are no core U.S. national security
no.
interests or core U.S. economic interests at stake in the conflict in
no,
Ukraine.
Right.
We if Ukraine became Belarus, that would be a local tragedy, but it would not actually affect America's role in the world, America's ability to be a superpower or project power. And I would also say, Peter, really quick, look, we got to pay more attention to China and pay more attention to the actual issues that are facing our country here as we begin, you know, this sort of, new era of U.S. foreign policy.
When Joe started that, I will not bow down. And I mean, I just let the air go out of the room. I said, Joe, what are you talking about bowing down? I mean, did you get the sense of that, Michael? What was that all about?
Yeah, that was odd. There were a few moments like that really just were a little inexplicable. And again, this is the point I try to make to people. It doesn't have to be either or, right? We don't have to stick our heads in the sand and ignore what's going on. And, you know, I'm not an isolationist. I don't advocate for isolationism. But we can have something between, you know, America's role as this global policeman and that sort of other end of the spectrum. And that's what I would argue is we can make priorities and we can focus on a more realistic foreign policy. And look, Ukraine is just not a very high priority for the United States right now. And we can make a more responsible level of involvement in Ukraine without bowing to Putin or Russia or anybody.
The military-industrial complex, the war machine, they love it. Switch over to, if I would, last couple of moments. Gaza now, Israelis. I don't know where Biden is with this. He says that there's no greater supporter of the state of Israel, and this is not away from everything. But now, I mean, I don't understand the complexities of that. I suspect it ends in some form of ceasefire. But even then what? So how do you see that?
Yeah, look, I think this is really the million-dollar question right now. If you care about foreign policy, is what is the end state in Gaza and who administers post-conflict governance? You know, is it going to be some kind of Arab coalition? Is it going to be the Israelis? Is there going to be some kind of UN peacekeeping force? I mean, there are so many questions here about what this looks like even after kind of the end of the fighting. And then you also have to ask, look, you know, what is going to prevent the rise of a Hamas 2.0, right? What kind of structural changes are going to?
Of course there will be.
Yeah, look, I think that's a very real risk here. And I think, again, I bring back to this, you know, come back to this peer proposal that Biden put forward in the State of the Union, that, you know, the U.S. getting involved directly with potentially U.S. Marines on the beach in Gaza is just a recipe for disaster. And it doesn't even matter what your politics are or what your perspective is on, Israel or Gaza or Palestine or any of it, right? If you don't want the U.S. to be in a situation for the next 10 or 20 years, we're potentially roped into peacekeeping operations in Gaza, you know, then you should be opposed to this. And so I don't really think we have a clear answer from the Arabs, from the Israelis, or from Joe Biden on what, again, the end state is here. And this is where, on the foreign policy side, Peter, I'm just really concerned that we're in a post-policy world in a lot of ways, where all you have to do is virtue signal or make a quick little statement about how bad, you know, Russia is or whatever, and you don't actually have to have a strategy. You don't actually have to have a policy. And so I think we have to get back to kind of the old school statecraft of, you know, some of the folks you were talking about earlier in the show. We got to be a serious country and have a serious foreign policy. And I think it starts with getting into the weeds on solutions to these problems rather than just sort of trying to, you know, look like you're on the right side of them.
What was the great line that every war of national liberation in the Third World knew? We don't have to win. We just don't lose. And
right.
And if anyone thinks that there's going to be an elimination of Hamas, you can kill all the people you want, but that will only ferment or ignite even more of the same. And it seems to me, from my reading, it takes about 8 to 10 years. And I don't think this was an intifada, but I think it comes close. But then it rises again and rises again. And I have no idea, once again, what Joe Biden's positions or his aims are. And again, it's like you point out, these are the two hot spots in the world right now. And I'm going to give you final comments on both, Ukraine and Gaza. My sense of Joe Biden, he's palms up right now on both. Your thoughts?
I would agree, Peter. I think, and that should be concerning to everybody, regardless of, again, what your politics are, what your party is. The president of the United States is basically, you know, shrugging and sort of, you know, throwing his hands up. And we have two major conflicts going around in the world. And there's been no leadership. There's been no strategy. There's been no answer. And I think, again, you know, as someone that was personally involved in the counter-ISIS fight, you're very right. It's, you know, it's very hard to eliminate an ideology, right? And that's the same issue that we're seeing here with Hamas is nobody really is interested in answering that second and third order question because it's hard to answer of, well, what comes next? Well, probably more of the same. So I think those are the big concerns. And I think as the president, Joe Biden owes us a lot more answers on both.
And I don't expect to hear them. But again, it's that and it's history teaching all of us. We don't have to win. We just don't lose. And eventually we will. Michael's last name is spelled D-I-M-I-N-O. We'll have him back again and again. Michael, you're a gift, man. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you, Peter. It's always great to talk to you.
Be safe. Thank you, sir. All right. What we're going to do is do a quick turn. And again, we've been talking about old and Joe Williams and Sandy Clough, some of my true favorites coming on the show. Mike Tyson's taking a fight. He'll be 58 when the bell rings. Talk about Biden's age. And then Rupert Murdoch, 92 years of age, is engaged for the second time in 12 months, this time to a woman he met through his third wife. You got to love Rupert. All right, 303-696-1971. Hold on your hats. I'm Peter Boyles. 53 the high today. It's 710 KNUS. Good morning, everybody. Saturday, 53 will be the high today and 62 on Sunday. This is 710 KNUS Denver's talk station. I'm Peter Boyles. Good to have you here. Spring forward tonight, and you just listened to Billy and Jeff. We do something called The Shoot, and it's a YouTube TV, and it's up on our website. Go to 710knus.com, click on shows, click on me, and The Shoot will show up. And Billy and Jeff do The Shoot talking about their new morning show. Sandy Clough and Joe Williams coming up, 303-696-1971. What is too old? Ski season in full swing, and the snow is great. I'm going this week. You know what it means? It's Larson Ski and Sport. Get all your new gear. This is everyone's favorite time of the year because now the days are brighter and longer and the snow is there. It's been tons of snow and it's a lot warmer. So this is a good time. A lot of people choose to start skiing. So take it from me. If you need any ski or snowboard gear, Larson Ski and Sport. They're our friends. They do it the best. The guys at Larson's will take the time to get to know you and get to know the family and match you with all the right brands, and you can enjoy your time on the hill. See the man, John Marriott, Jack Marriott, Paul, everybody at Larson's. So convenient. Stop by on the way up the hill or stop on the way home. The big wooden building, south of I-70 on Kipling. You are westbound on I-70. Get off on the Kipling exit. Come down the ramp, make a left, go south underneath I-70, come out the other side, look to the right, and you see a big wooden box building, right? There's a crab shack, and then there's Larson's. 7 days a week, there is absolutely nothing that you need for skiing or for boarding that they don't have. For everything from helmets to warm clothes to stylish equipment, and they really know what they're doing. Please rent the demos, rent for your kids and grandkids. Larson's Ski and Sports, south of I-70 on Kipling. 7 days a week, 303-423-0654, or L-A-R-S-O-N, LarsonSport.com. Well, do we have doctor with us? Okay, let me do this real quick before we go on. Here's a true favorite. We began hyperbaric treatments, my daughter and I, and one of my friends from 1,000 years ago, introduced me to this, the H-Bot Spa. Dr. Jeff McWhorter, sir. Hey, Jeffrey, good morning. Thanks for coming up on the show again.
Yeah, good morning, Pete. How are you?
You know, I'm well, and I'm well but because of a lot of the stuff that we've done. We now, and I talked to my daughter. My daughter's in class right now, but she normally joins us. But,
yeah.
I mean, it is, I can't explain how oxygen therapy has changed both of us, and I know you and Mel and everybody. Talk about how and why it works.
Yeah, it works because we're aerobic organisms, man. Every cell in our body requires oxygen to function. So therefore, as we increase our oxygen saturation through doing hyperbaric therapy, we're able to sustain a greater saturation level of about a 99 to 100% of our oxygen capacity, which equates to better overall cellular function. So as somebody who firsthand can attest, coming off of an ACL surgery, complete replacement last year, about June, back out here playing tennis 6 months earlier than my doctors thought I would be, I give all of that an attribution towards hyperbaric oxygen therapy.
I tried to explain it. Yeah. You get into a chamber, and I'm claustrophobic. And my daughter went twice, and I'm sitting watching her, and I thought, I can't sell this on the air unless I actually do it. And for those of you who claustrophobia may be holding you back, it ain't like that at all. And I've read two books now, and I use the phone when I'm in there. You get in these, and the attendants are there. They zip you in. I have a light that I take with me, and I have a fan, and right. I've been pillows, and I read, and it blows up. How and why does it blow up again, Jeff? Yeah.
So it's compressing the oxygen out of our air and pumping that into that chamber, so your body's absorbing it atmospherically. But all of my clinics take it a little step further by putting enriched oxygen concentrators through the respiratory system as well. So you get a twofold benefit. And much like Peter, you just said, we make it the most comfortable environment for you to be in there. I tend to watch Netflix or SportsCenter while I'm taking my hour, 2 hour long hyperbaric on a daily basis. And the promotion that we're running right now gives you the opportunity to come in, try it firsthand, make sure that it's a good fit for you, but realize the promotion's just to get you exposed to the modality. The real magic happens after you're consistent with it for at least about 10 to 20 sessions minimum. So we want you to come in, try it out, and then make an educated decision on committing to doing therapy that's going to add longevity to your life and better energy throughout your day with a quicker healing process taking place all along.
Now, Victoria is right there. She's right there now, and she is one of the women that makes this work. The phone number is, please take this, 303-353-9623. It's 303-353-9623. Victoria answers the phone. Go and try it.
Yeah, check us out on the web as well. You can find us at the HBOT spa.com. And that same handle will pop up on Instagram if you want to see what's going on a daily basis in that clinic. We're located right in Cherry Creek, and we look forward to helping you achieve your longevity goals.
And what you could have fooled me, and it works. 303-353-9623. Victoria is there. You can visit them online, as Doctor said, the HBOTspa.com. I'll talk to you over the weekend, Doctor. Thank you. And please, everybody, give this one a shot. Thank you, sir. Be safe.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
You too. All right. Let's go back to our phones. We start with Don. Lines are jammed. It's Saturday morning. Hey, Don, good morning. You're on the radio show.
Hey, Peter. Good morning. Good to chat with
you.
Been a while.
Thank you.
So I guess you're talking a couple things. You're talking about how old is too old?
Yes.
Or old?
Yes.
I think that has an awful lot to do with who you are and how lucky you were in the penis club, because some people are old at 50, and then there's people like me, 73, who work every day, 12, 14 hours a day.
Yeah.
Then there's people who just keep going. I don't know about Murdoch. If I had his money, I could probably be like Dick Cheney, live forever. But who said that?
Rupert Murdoch is 90. No, for real. Rupert Murdoch's 92 years old, got engaged for the second time in 12 months, and this time to a woman he met through his third wife. You and I couldn't make that up.
Well, I couldn't afford the penile implants. Come on.
No, it's got to be more than that. I mean, there's got to be something going on. I mean, I don't know.
Then,
well, no, I mean, there has to be the will before there's the way, right? I mean,
do they check him for dementia?
No, that's the other one. Is we're talking about Joe Biden. We're talking about, how about Tyson getting back in the ring? It'll be 58 when the bell. He'll be 58 when the bell rings. You got him in this fight?
I love Iron Mike. I'd never ever count him out.
Thank you. Wouldn't. And he's training. You know, he's training. Yeah.
He's you know, there's only a few in every sport over the course of time. Mike Tyson's like one in the top, period.
Remember,
I wish Ali and Tyson would have been the same age. God, that'd have been a card.
What do you think? Who do you think? That's a great question.
I don't know. Yeah. From brutality,
yeah,
Tyson,
yeah.
But from rope-a-dope and finesse and, you know, whatever, you know, you got to wonder, well, Muhammad, when Cassius Clay was on, you can touch him. Yeah,
you watched
Liston,
him.
What a fool he made of Liston and many others.
If those fights were, with respect, because I love Muhammad, but I don't know if Sonny went down or not, and then that'll be an argument forever, the punch
went
that no
down
one
with a needle in his arm in downtown Denver in an alley.
Well, no, they found him dead in Vegas, but they found that the needle, the kill mark was in the wrong arm. I think Sonny was right-handed.
I thought he was in Denver.
No, he died in Vegas. Here's one
I'll
for
trust you on that.
No, I guarantee it. But here's one that is a great trivia question. When they made a television movie on the life of Sonny, who played Sonny?
I don't know.
Ron Lyle.
There we go, Ron Lyle.
Ron Lyle and I became real close friends. Yeah, no, I'll tell you what.
My ex-wife worked at the law firm that represented him.
Oh, man, which one?
Atlers, Hall, and Halligman.
I'll tell you. And you know what? And we were friends, and we would sit and talk, and we called a couple of fights together, and he talked about
a dangerous man.
Oh, facing and then I'll shut up about it. There's a documentary called Facing Ali. Did you ever see it? The people that fought Muhammad.
No,
it's a great doc. Anyhow,
no,
and Ron Lyle's in it. We talked hours about the Ali fight and he was ahead. He was ahead on points with Ali, but I don't know. I love this idea that Tyson's coming back in. Thank you for your call. Thank you very much.
Hey,
go ahead. All right.
Did you read a book by Sal Polis, The Sinatra Club?
Yes, I did. In fact, we had him on the show.
I just read that. I'm going to tell you, I got to read it again because it just added a whole new different layer to that period of time. We'll talk again.
Here's what I'm reading right now. The Gotti Wars, about the guy who's one of the prosecutors after Jack Alone, and they blow it, and then they're the ones that got
Maloney, the
woman, yeah, Diane, and
yeah, Jack
Maloney, and then they come back and they get him. But it's called the Gotti Wars. We'll get this guy on the show. He's the best. Thanks. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave.
You're welcome. Yeah, all right, we in time. We're doing good, Lou. What's up? Take a break. All right, 303-696-1971. Coming up, Sandy Clough and Joe Williams. We got to talk about this. Mike Tyson's taking a fight against Jake Paul. 710 KNUS, spring break time in Arvada, Army Navy Surplus. Wonderful place. Kenny and I rode up motorcycles up there. Serving customers in Old Town Arvada since 1984. Spring break deals are on now. Men's swimsuits, Hawaiian shirts, $14.99. A genuine canvas travel kit bag for $8.99. Tell them about the ad. Get 20% off selected sunglasses, 15% off all these great water bottles, hydro flask. I'm learning about this stuff. And discounts, and I got my socks, darn tough socks, Ocean Beach travel belts. Steven and the staff, highly knowledgeable, and they'll assist you in finding all the gear you need for all your next spring break adventures. Springtime's coming. Remember, tonight, spring ahead, Stephen and the guys are there. The store is so cool. Things to check out. And remember just walking around Army Navy surplus stores when you were a kid. All the military gear they have on display, and everybody loves them. And stop by and see Old Town Arvada and check them out, arvadasurplus.com. That's Arvada Surplus, arvadasurplus.com. Better believe it's Saturday morning, everybody. 53 the high, 62 on Sunday. Phone number 303-696-1971. Lines are full. And again, the shoot, if you go to the website, then click on shows, click on me, and you can scroll it down. And the shoot is Billy and Jeff, the new morning show. 710 KNUS, Sandy Clef and Joe Williams coming up. We'll start at the top. We'll start with Nick. Hey, Nick, you're on the radio show. It's Saturday. Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
A couple of months or so ago, somebody who knows something about boxing rated who is the best boxer in terms of the speed of the punch and the power of the punch, and I can't remember the third category. And Muhammad Ali came in, I think, second or third.
Sure.
Tyson came in first as far as the power of the punch. But there were two other boxers involved that had more speed and more something else, which I cannot remember. But I found that interesting.
Was it Sugar? The original Sugar Ray Robinson. Walker Smith was his real name. Sugar Ray Robinson, the original Sugar. Coming up, Joe Williams, who really is a good historian. He's agreed upon, that most people agree, that it was Ray. And then there's guys like Harry Greb, and there's all these remarkable fighters in the 30s and 20s. And it's hard to judge. Your point's well taken. But,
you know, people love to compare, well, could Muhammad Ali take on Joe Louis? So the thing is, when you're comparing two different fighters from a completely different generation, it's almost impossible to get to a neutral playing field. It's just
I agree.
Difficult.
I totally agree. I mean, you think of the fighters who overcame so much, and of course Jack Johnson, but it's Joe Louis, it's the Bomber. I mean, he overcomes so much.
How about Frazier?
You know what? One of my great regrets in this business is never attempting to talk to Joe Frazier, and I perhaps could have done so by phone. And I mentioned this so many times. If you're a fan and a reader, there's a book entitled Ghosts of Manila. Muhammad said, me and Joe went to Manila champions. We came home ghosts.
Yes. I mean, Frazier, he probably did more damage to Muhammad Ali than any fighter.
Agreed.
I mean, he wasn't as tall, but I mean, he had a punch that could knock out a tank.
And legitimately, and I don't think Muhammad had it back for him, but he had it for Muhammad, because Muhammad tommed him. And and if there was one guy that really did help him when he was down and out, was Joe Frazier, in that famous car ride when Joe picks him up in the Lincoln and they're in Philly, and he gives him the money to continue to support his family. And
you're talking about to help Muhammad Ali?
Yeah, to help Muhammad out. And then Muhammad started, doing what he did to him. And Joe never forgave him. I mean, there's a story that they were supposed to be, they buried the hatchet in the end. But what he did to Joe, was uncalled for.
Well, that shows a lot of ingratitude on the part of Muhammad Ali. Come on.
Well, Muhammad thinks he's building the gate. And Joe is taking it seriously. I mean, if all of those guys, Joe came off of an island off the coast of Carolina. It was just horrible. And that's where he came from. Muhammad came
an
from.
An island off of where?
Off the coast of Carolina. No, his dad, their family, I mean, they were just laborers in this terrible situation. And Muhammad's father, I believe, worked for the Postal Service. And I'm not telling you everything was sweetness and light, but in Louisville, they were black middle class. And Joe was off the bottom of the, I mean, the bottom of the barrel.
That's exactly right. He had to fight his way all the way to the top.
Absolutely. And he died. I was always kind of mixed on Floyd Mayweather, but when Joe died broke. And Floyd.
But what happened to all the money?
Don't know. Just, you know, like a lot of prize fighters. And it was Floyd Mayweather paid for his funeral. Paid for Sinatra paid for Joe Louis's funeral.
I heard, and you know a lot more about it than I do, that Joe Louis was so down on his luck that somebody discovered him face down drunk in some street in Las Vegas.
I wouldn't be surprised. I've never heard that, but I wouldn't have been surprised. His son is here.
But he gave him a job and gave him a chance to kind of get going again.
He became a greeter. He was a greeter in like the Sands or the Dunes or something.
Right.
And when you got there, you met the bomber. There's a wonderful book entitled it's Black Champion in White America about Joe Louis getting the strap and how the media wrote about him and the things that were said about him. And Jack Johnson had so poisoned the well in White America because of, you know, dating white women and crossing the state line and all that kind of stuff that they were never going to let a black guy near that strap again. And along comes Joe. And his father was one of the Tuskegee syphilis experiments. Was Joe Louis, and Joe's last name was Barrow, and he fought under this other name because he didn't want his mother to know he was in the ring, that he was fighting in the ring. But those old fighters, oh man, I mean, just the great stories about them, the legends about them. And
correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah. 100 years ago or 80 years ago, whatever it was, there were no 15 rounds. You fought till somebody dropped.
Well, they quit 15-round fights. A drop was a round under Marcus the Queensberry, which is in and of itself. So they would draw a line. And even now when you hear, I mean, I heard it from my grandmother and everything, they would say, toe the line. Well, they fought in pits, and there would be a line drawn. And fighters wore shoes that had, like, I don't want to say cleats, but more like, or not spikes, but more like cleats. And if you took a punch and went down on one knee, that was a round. And that's where you would get those 40-round fights and that kind of stuff.
Oh, okay.
And
okay.
So,
all right.
But if you, the last guy, the if you could not toe the line, put your toe on that line and dig in, the fight was over. And so they would scream, toe the line, by God, toe the line. And,
right.
And they were drinking whiskey and, you know, and during rounds and
right.
No, I mean, and they soaked their hands. I've read this history. They're not wearing gloves. I mean, they don't wear gloves until Jake Kilrain.
Right.
Jake Kilrain's putting on gloves. But it was walnuts brine, the brine of the, and they would soak their hands in walnut brine to turn their hands into whatever they would turn their hands into. And they'd break their hands, you know, break their noses. And they were just so, I mean, and they weren't allowed to fight. Remember, they fight on barges and, you know, and then they build places for them to go fight. And I was enamored by those guys. I mean, how tough they really were. And I'm taking nothing away from the modern fighters. But.
Well, do you think that all those fighters did what they did because they couldn't make a living any other way?
The history of boxing is the history of the underclass of America.
Right.
Whether it was initially the Irish, you know, Jake Kilrain and John L. and those guys. And
right.
Then and it sort of moves its way through. And now you look at who the fighters are. And
mostly black.
And when the black fighters were allowed in, or the Russians, or, you know, the same thing. The one place where that hasn't really locked on is the UFC, MMA fighting, which I really have come. I just love MMA. But if you go back into the 30s and the Great American Depression and before, it's the Irish fighters. And then there were Jewish fighters who changed their name. They would pick up Irish names to get fights. and they could fight under, as they said, a Hibernian name. And no one knew. I mean, there's no, you know, I take a fight in this town tonight, and then 2 weeks from now, I take a fight in another town under another name. And, and then the mob ran it. You know, Joe Williams is great on stuff like that, because when there was a guy named Frankie Carbo, and he was part of the Gambinos, I think. And I told you, one of the highlights, and I've been such a lucky man to get to meet these people, but Jake LaMotta. And I did a television show with Jake for an hour, and we talked. It's called The Fox Fight, where he wanted a shot. He wanted in to get it, and he had to lay down, and the other fighter's name was Fox. And he went in the tank. He took the price. And so the mob made all the money because Jake was the favorite fighter and Fox won the fight.
Didn't Robert De Niro make a movie about that?
Yeah, The Raging Bull. Yeah, it's a
Raging Bull. Of
Raging
course.
Bull. And that's pretty true. I mean, it's all about the and when I met Jake, it was like, you know, he was, and I always wanted my dad to be alive then, because we watched Jake's fights, and I met Gene Fulmer. You know, I met a lot of those guys that I watched when I was a kid, and I thought, God, would I love my dad to be sitting here right now, because we watched that stuff together. And then
How many of the fighters do you think would have chosen another way to make a living if they could?
Wow. They wanted to fight. That's the thing. I'm being told I got a break. No, they wanted to fight.
I thought a lot of them had to do it because there was no other way to make it.
Well, that's the underclass. That's right. That's making it. But they liked fighting. I mean, you're right. I mean, on another moment, another time, somebody sent them to college, they might have turned into football players or something. But
whatever.
Yeah.
Right.
I love the call. Great call, man. Call of the day.
Bye-bye.
All right, we come back, do a quick turnaround, and the boys will be with us. Stay here.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.